Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 171 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.fm. Or download the MP3 after broadcast using iTunes or other podcast apps. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. Remember that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you would like to sponsor this show as an individual or advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Even a few dollars a month helps. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. And now in feedback, Mindy referred to this show as wonderful and recommended a professor, Tim Noakes, to talk about the keto diet or what he calls the Banting diet. So I will be looking into that. So please keep suggestions for new guests coming. I often do these shows based on a tip from a listener. Sometimes I talk to an expert in a particular area, but at other times I talk to a person who has an individual experience that illustrates something much bigger. That's the case today, where we talk about pesticides. As an aside, President Obama banned the dangerous pesticide chlorpyrifos, but for all the talk of draining a swamp, Trump's EPA chief, Scott Pruitt, won't be getting chlorpyrifos out of the swamp because he canceled that order. Robin Westman once was just an ordinary guy living a quiet life with his wife and young kids in rural British Columbia, Canada. But that changed one day when his curious children were exposed to drifting pesticide from a neighbor spraying goodness knows what. Their serious health crisis woke him up to the danger and made him realize how powerless he was, or maybe not. Welcome to the show, Robin and Shelley.
Thanks, David. We're really happy to share our story. And
yeah, let's start by telling the story of the day your children, two sons, I believe, got ill because of pesticide spray.
Well, actually, David, it was my whole family. And it began, the ordeal began in 2012 when six neighbors got together and they decided to rid the neighborhood of broadleaf vegetation and dandelions. And the main sprayer used a quad-equipped commercial pesticide sprayer. And we were not only exposed to the drift, we actually live on the southeast part of the cul-de-sac, so our house actually got the majority of the drift that came down. But what happened was, is the quad sprayer, we call him Quad Man, he's been dubbed Quad Man,
right,
actually pulled onto our boulevard. He trespassed onto our boulevard and sprayed my children through the fence.
You're not saying he was deliberately spraying your children, he was spraying the grass, but your children were on the other side of the fence.
That's
and got
correct.
It.
We don't believe, obviously, it was intentional. What happened was, is that when he did pull onto the boulevard, my children were behind the fence trying to see what was going on, and they got dosed pretty good with the stuff. And it was my twin boys, who were at the time 3 years old, and then my older son, who at that time was 5 years old.
Oh, okay. And so three children.
So three children. And
yes.
Actually, it was four. My older daughter, 21 years old, is lying in the yard kind of looking after them. You know, totally oblivious to the fact that there was this major cosmetic lawn pesticide spraying going on.
Right. Now, a quad, I don't know if everybody calls it a quad. Is that the same as an all-terrain vehicle?
Yeah, it's an all-terrain vehicle.
Right. Small vehicle with four big wheels designed for driving through mud or over rocky terrain and stuff.
That's correct.
So I think people have got the picture. Do your children have allergies to... Well, first of all, let's describe the symptoms of what happens to your children, how soon afterwards, and what kind of symptoms did they have?
Sure. Well, immediately afterwards, my children were affected, and my wife is here, and I'm just wondering if she wants to explain. Shelley, do you want to explain to David what exactly happened and how the children responded? So this is Shelley, David.
Okay.
And she'll tell you what she experienced and what their symptoms were.
Yeah. Hi, Shelley.
Hello, David. I just want to thank you so much for letting us share this information. I'll just be short with how we experienced the ordeal of Sean almost dying. What happened is, as Robin said, in 2012, all three kids were doused badly through the fence.
Mm-hmm.
And the spraying continued each year. So by 2016, that's when we dealt with Sean, one of my twins, almost dying. And they had sprayed in the morning. We went out for the day, and by about 8 o'clock in the evening, I was tucking Sean up to say goodnight to him, and he complained of a sore throat. And I got up to get some water for him, and by the time I got back to his bedroom, he was holding his throat, saying that he cannot breathe.
Wow.
It happened so fast, so quick. And he collapsed, and we did call the response guys.
911?
Was 911, and then the first response guys, they came.
Right.
And assisted him with oxygen, and the sad part is the guys, they were part of the spraying. One of them was the guy that came to give my son oxygen.
And did he realize what he'd done?
Not at all. Totally oblivious to the fact it was the spraying. So when the paramedics arrived, even the paramedics said they've never experienced seeing a child so distressed. They'd seen asthma and croup and upper respiratory complaints from children, but this was different, and they couldn't match it together to anything. And anyhow, Sean was rushed to the hospital. We spent a night in ER with him, and they gave him all the drugs necessary. He was discharged the next day, but from that day on, his health has been on and off. His immune system is absolutely shot. And I experienced 6 months of him waking up between 2 to 4 o'clock at night with this horrific rash all over his body. And he was even oozing, sapping under his arms and behind his knees. And we took him to homeopaths, naturopaths, doctors, allergists. And it's just been an ongoing struggle with his health.
And so he's having rashes with no particular reason. They just happen. There's no trigger. It just, he'll get a rash.
Yes. And even now, if he's triggered off with any kind of chemical, any wheat or anything that's been doused with the Roundup, he'll be affected. And so I had to take him out of school, homeschooled him and his twin brother, Shay, for a year, and we placed him on pure, clean, organic food, and we're still having issues to this day. He's losing his hair, he's had lumps under his arms, and he's had extreme fear of even going outside in the summertime now in case the neighbors spray.
And they're still, I guess we'll get into this, but they're still continuing to spray regularly?
They are continuing, not with the quad spray. At this point last year they didn't, but they do one spray. Yeah, and you know, they spray like as if it's a hose pipe.
Yes.
They don't just spray directly on the weed. So, I mean, Robin and I, we're definitely moving on. We cannot stay within this area now. It's way too dangerous for our kids.
Yes, yes, it sounds like it. Do we know what they were spraying?
At this stage, it's still a real mystery. At that first spray in 2012, probably Robin will go more into that part. I think the most part that I feel so saddened about is that we have had absolutely no support from the authorities here in Canada, from the police to Health Canada to the pesticide management.
The Pesticide Regulatory Management Agency, the PRMA.
That's right.
Yeah, we'll talk. I want to go through all of those organizations that potentially could have helped you, but as you indicate, did not.
No, there was no help at all. Robin can go more into those details.
Yeah, okay, well, let's get him back on the phone, and we'll talk about what pesticides are used and who you contacted and things like that.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Shelley.
Okay. Hi, David. Shelley summed it up pretty good as far as the symptoms, but it's much more intricate, and there's more details to it, and I don't know if you want me to share them. As far as the attitudes, the behaviors, and the actions of these individuals, now...
Well, I don't think that's maybe the most important thing. I'd like to know what the authorities did. I mean, these people, you know, were spraying pesticides they probably shouldn't have, but, you know, in a perfect world, somebody would have come and stopped them, educate them about the danger of what they were doing, things like that. And so I'd really like to talk about who you contacted in the, you know, what their response was when you said, my neighbors are spraying on my property, I don't know what they're spraying, it's affecting the health of my children. Who did you contact first?
Well, the first contact we made was after my children became symptomatic, and that was the very next day, and we contacted the poison control office. And we told them the symptoms, told them that we had been told by then that all that the neighbor knew is that he sprayed Killex or a pesticide that was received from the quad man's brother in Saskatchewan. That's the first information that we received. And so we took that information and we told them that it was either Killex or some pesticide, and we told them the symptoms. And they said, well, it sounded consistent with herbicide poisoning.
Okay.
And we told them that the symptoms were not as bad as they were the previous day when they did get sprayed, and we were advised to go ahead and take them to emergency or take them to the doctor, which is what we did. So
right.
So that was the first contact. And so the second thing is that we contacted a few days later the rural district of East Kootenay, mm-hmm. the pesticide regulatory guy there, and who was at the time the guy in charge of pesticide spraying in the rural district.
Right.
Well, he was totally not knowledgeable and just basically said, well, they're allowed to spray and you can spray. I said, well, are they allowed to spray the where they're spraying? Well, he didn't really have the answers, and he said, but, you know, there's nothing you can do. They're allowed to spray. And
but, I mean, even he said they're allowed to spray on somebody else's property?
Well, that's what he said. They're allowed to spray. See, part of the situation here is that nobody really wanted to talk about it. So when we got to the point where it could implicate somebody, either an authority figure or an individual concerning pesticides, people would not talk.
Well, what about talking to your neighbors? Did you ask
them? Oh, sure. Yeah, and that's one of the things when I talked about behaviors and actions. Well, immediately after, I went over to the neighbor that's closest to the fence, and I tried to talk with him. And I said, look, you know, I want you to know that what happened was my kids got sick. And the guy literally slammed the door in my face and said, are you trying to tell me what to do on my lawn? And slammed the door in my face and said, bring it on. And so that was the beginning of the animosity that was created. Here I am trying to tell these people about, you know, what happened to my son, and the neighbors are responding with, you crazy type of person. And this went on for several years, you know, for 4 years.
Right. So they've sprayed since then. I mean, do your kids get sick every time they spray? Is there a correlation there? Or?
Oh, absolutely. Every time they've sprayed, we've gone out, 2014, 2015. In 2015, for example, they were spraying again. We went out and I said, look, you know, it's really affecting my kids. They're getting sick. Oh, they were laughing and it was just a big, big joke to them. And so when they started spraying in 2015, I went out and I tried to speak with them. And then four of these guys' neighbors, four of the guys in the area, their wives came out and stood in the cul-de-sac and were kind of mocking me and making fun. I was on the phone talking to the rural district of East Kootenay. And talking to the same guy I talked to in 2012,
right.
He said he remembered me. I said, look, these guys are spraying again. They're using this quad. It's an illegal quad. It's not registered. They're spraying all over. They're spraying the boulevards. Is this legal? And finally he said, no, they shouldn't be doing that, but, you know, there's not really much we can do because we don't have jurisdiction.
Whoa, who's got jurisdiction?
Well, here's the thing. So they said, well, what we'll do is we'll put you in contact with the conservation officer. So we got in contact with the conservation officer. I'm literally on the phone while the four women are standing in the cul-de-sac while these guys are out spraying. I says, look, they're spraying right now, and what can be that? Well, you know, they're allowed to spray, but can they spray the way they're spraying? And it was, well, you know, okay, well, I'll come out. So a conservation officer came out who apparently was the pesticide guy. And it turns out that he had no jurisdiction whatsoever, had nothing really to say about it. He came out, he talked to the neighbor next door, and escalated the situation. It became even a bigger deal. It wasn't about how my son was harmed or being harmed by the spray. It was about the fact that they were allowed to do it, and there's not really much you can do. And besides that, pesticides are harmless.
Right, so they just sort of saw it as an individual rights thing. If I want to spray the hell out of my yard, why can't I? Kind of ignoring the fact that pesticide spray doesn't sort of stop at the boundary of their property.
Pretty much, and I think that's projected by the industry and by the authorities also. Well, pesticides are harmless. They don't really do any harm, so, you know, really, what are you talking about?
Yes. Well, you've learned a lot about pesticides, but let's continue down the road of authorities. So in Canada, Health Canada approves pesticides through an organization called the Pesticide Management Regulatory Agency, or PMRA, and there's a law called the Pest Controls Products Act.
That's correct.
So what does Health Canada say about the rights or the legality of the spraying that was going on?
Well, before I get into that, and I want to get into that, I got a lot to say about it. I just want to say there was one more chain of authority we went to here, and this was obviously the RCMP, the police.
Okay.
And so we contacted the police, and we actually went to the police after, it was a couple of days after it happened with Sean. We said, this is enough. We're going to go to the police. We went down, we talked to one of the authority figures there, the Cranbrook RCMP, and he was very, you know, very kind and listened to what we had to say. And he said, gee, you know, this is really tough. We don't know what to do. We don't know who's got jurisdiction, blah, blah, blah. So it took him a couple of weeks to call whoever he called and came back and said, well, you know, there's not really much we can do. And then he asked us for proof and all of this. And, of course, you can't prove anything if it's, you know, something that happened and affected the health. So we went through the RCMP. They did a quasi-investigation, sent it up to the BC Ministry of the Environment. So the BC
right.
Ministry of Environment got involved, and then the Pesticide Regulatory Management Agency around the same time.
Right, right.
So
everybody's passing the buck, and now it's pretty much as high as it can go.
It's pretty much as high as it can go. So we wrote a letter. I was in contact with an individual from the BC Ministry of the Environment. He was actually the first contact before the Pesticide Management Regulatory Agency person. So when I was contacted by the PMRA person, they said, well, BC Ministry of Environment has first jurisdiction because you contacted them first. So they put it on to BC Ministry of Environment. So it was several months before they did or said anything, and, you know, I kind of hounded them, and then I wrote a letter to Health Canada, and then that finally put a fire under the PMRA. So we received a letter from the PMRA saying, yes, we received your letter, and we're going to take a look at this. So it was another year before they concluded, quote, their investigation, which was really a joke. And it's a joke because we sent them documentation, pictures, audio, incident reports, documentation that clearly establishes the fact that these people were breaking the law. And the response we got from the BC Ministry of Environment was only about the fact that pesticides are allowed to be used.
Okay, well, you sent me a letter from the PMRA, and I'd like to read a few things in that letter, and maybe you can comment on them. These are responses to your questions, but I don't need to read your questions because I think it's pretty obvious in their response what you were asking about. So under the PCPA, the Pest Control Products Act, all pesticides must be used according to labeled directions. Some labels may specify maximum wind speeds at which the products may be applied. Others may provide best practice advice, and some labels do not address wind at all. Pesticide applicators are responsible for reading the pesticide label and complying with any stated wind precautions. So there's a legal requirement for some pesticides, at least, regarding wind. Who enforces this?
That's a very good question, David. And just in regards to the wind, on the spraying, the initial spraying in 2012, there unbeknownst to these neighbors and to Quadman, there were four other neighbors, actually six other neighbors, who witnessed the spraying and who were willing to testify the fact that it was very windy, because the four individuals who lived right behind one of our neighbors here got doused themselves with the chemical.
Right.
And even now, one of these neighbors, or one of these individuals, is willing to testify to the fact that it was a very windy day.
And you said one of your neighbors lost an animal because of the spraying.
Yes, that's another aspect of this. Right behind Quadman, there was a very nice family that had witnessed the spraying for several years also. And the spraying was coming over onto their land. And in the first video that we created, there's audio testimony of her talking about the fact that this guy would reach over and spray would go over into her yard 15 to 20 feet, and they measured it and documented it and sent it to the RDEK, and even still, all they said was talk to your neighbor. There was no enforcement regulation or policy there.
So, but I mean, okay, so PMRA has said it's, you know, depending on the label, and let's just assume that the label has some wind requirements. We don't really know exactly what was being sprayed, so possibly they could get off on a technicality, but probably it says something about the wind. PMRA certainly doesn't know that the label doesn't say anything. And so did they say who would come out and read the Riot Act to somebody spraying illegally?
No, of course not, and that's a very good question. And I think the whole idea of labeling is a hoax, and we can get into that if you want to.
Okay, well, they also said, under the Pest Control Products Act, labels dictate the sites on which products might be used, e.g. grass, apples, ornamentals, etc. However, it does not regulate trespass or property lines. So you're basically saying under the Canadian Pest Control Products Act, you can spray wherever the hell you want, I guess.
Right, and if the act was broken, well, you have to contact the authorities.
And who are the authorities?
Exactly.
I think we're going around in circles here.
Yeah. Okay. One more point, David.
Yes.
Is that I did send you some pictures, and
yes, you did.
One of the pictures shows this guy, this neighbor, carrying two different types of pesticides over to a third party to spray. And the pictures reveal that. Those pictures were the pictures that were given to me from this neighbor that was impacted that was talked about.
And yet we don't know what these are. We don't know if they're mixing things together. We don't know if they're using them at double the concentration they're supposed to be. You don't know if they're mixing a herbicide and insecticide together. You really don't know too much.
That's exactly it. You're right.
And if you don't know, I mean, you might have a pesticide that has specific health impacts, and so all you can tell poison control is it was a pesticide, probably herbicide. That's not really too specific.
That's right. That's all we could say at the time. Okay. We do have more information now, and we can get into that later. But
right. Okay, we're continuing with the PMRA. A pesticide application that causes harm to human health or safety or the environment is a contravention of the PCPA. However, there must be verifiable evidence establishing a direct link between the pesticide application and the resulting harm for any enforcement action to be considered. I find that interesting because, you know, if you're doing something illegal, they don't need to prove that it actually hurt somebody. Like, if you drive down the road like a maniac, you know, you're driving at double the speed limit on the opposing lane, you don't have to hit anybody for you to get arrested.
Right. you're right. And this is part of the what I call now the illusion of the whole thing, is that we know now that, you know, these are damaging, these are hurtful.
Right.
And the documentation is out there.
Yes. Okay. Further things they said, applicators are not required to give any notification of pesticide applications in residential areas unless indicated on the label. The Act does not require homeowners to be licensed or certified unless indicated on the labels. Then it says the products used in this situation did not have such requirements. I mean, do they know for sure what products are being used?
Right. Well, what I do know from a letter that I received back from the so-called investigation they did was that he used Kylex. They said Kylex.
And what is Kylex? It's a brand name, but
okay. Well, we can get into Kylex. Kylex is a brand name that consists of three herbicides, and I'm going to read a direct quote to you from a research scientist named Anthony Samsel concerning Kylex and what he said about it. Can I do that?
Sure. Okay. Tell us a little bit about Anthony Samsel.
Okay, well, Anthony Samsel is a research scientist consultant, Samsel Environmental and Public Health Services. This is a very, in my opinion, courageous individual, and he's been doing a lot of the research concerning glyphosate and the effects of glyphosate on human health, him and along with Stephanie Seneff, Dr. Stephanie Seneff.
And where are they based?
They're based in the United States. I'm not sure exactly where. Stephanie Seneff is from MIT, and Anthony Samsel is in New Hampshire, I believe.
Okay. So what did he say about Kylex?
So, well, first of all, just my contact with him was through one of our leading activists in Canada named Tony Mitra.
Okay.
And Tony Mitra put me in contact with him and helped me understand how these products affected the health of my child. So anyhow, here's what he says. He says they were actually in a conversation about whether or not it was glyphosate or something else, and I had mentioned Kylex, and he said absolutely they were sprayed with something much worse than glyphosate, Kylex. He says, quote, "The product Kylex is a toxic herbicide cocktail of dicamba, 2,4-D or diphenoxy, and mecoprop, MCPP. This is a synergistic cocktail for all things. These are nasty chemical toxins which cause long-term health problems. This material is manufactured in Ontario." He goes on to talk about that. Then he says, "Dicamba herbicide is corrosive to the skin and eyes and will cause pain, nausea, coughing, vomiting, rash, difficulty breathing, blurred vision, and possible convulsions. My sons had some of those symptoms."
Yes.
"And also cause permanent health effects." Now, this can also cause permanent health effects. It's highly mobile in soil and can contaminate water supplies, including ponds, streams, and wells. It's a nasty chemical. These people sprayed, I've got documentation how they sprayed around wells, big rings around wells, they sprayed chemicals around it.
I mean, it amazes me that these people don't kill themselves, carelessness.
if we talk about health problems, we can get into that also, but that's a different story.
Well, I mean, if they've been experiencing health problems themselves, I guess that would be interesting.
It would be very interesting. And I can talk about the cancer in this area also, and the fact that we never did finish the idea of what happened to that neighbor's pet. That neighbor's pet, 2-year-old cat, died, or they had to put it to death because put it down because it had really, really bad neurological problems that happened very quickly.
Do you know what kind of a pesticide dicamba is? It is like an organophosphate, organochlorine. I don't know too much about it.
You know what? I'm not sure, but I know that 2,4-D is an organophosphate.
2,4-D is an organochlorine, I'm pretty sure. But, whatever. They're both nasty stuff.
Yeah, nasty. Anyhow, Anthony Samsel goes on and talks about Mecoprop, it's causes skin and eye irritation, burning sensation in chest, diarrhea, which is what my children had, and dizziness, confusion, bizarre behavior, and kidney failure. And 2,4-D, of course, causes inflammation, itching, headache, difficulty breathing, coughing, anorexia, lethargy. It is a neurotoxin and can affect coordination and induce stiffness in legs and arms. This material is a mutagen and causes chromosomal aberrations. There is an increased risk of tumor. Now, this is where this becomes very interesting, because Anthony Samsel kind of prophesied or predicted something that we are praying to God is not going to happen and come true within
yes.
my family and my son.
Anyhow, well, yes, I'm with you. What's happened is bad enough. You don't need to get a lot.
Well, we sent you the pictures now, and you might want to mention this, the pictures of my son losing his hair. We took the pictures mm-hmm. last night with both my twin boys having a ring around their mouth, which indicates a damaged gut microbiome.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I mean, these things are poisons. They wouldn't kill plants or animals. And to claim that things are specific for, you know, plants or animals, not both, is a bit ridiculous, because, you know, plants and animals share a lot of the same chemical pathways, and so there's a lot of crossover. It might be that an insecticide is most toxic to insects. That doesn't mean it's only toxic to insects.
Right. David, are you familiar with Don Huber, retired professor emeritus from Purdue University?
No.
Well, he's an expert in plant pathology, and he's the one that educated Stephanie Seneff on glyphosate and its dangers. Anyhow, what he says is that what all herbicides do is they serve as regulatory mechanisms for our enzyme systems, and they chelate. All the herbicides have a chelating process, and they immobilize nutrients and shut down physiological processes. That's essentially how they all work, how all weed killers work. They do that, and I think that a lot of people forget to mention, you know, glyphosate is the big one that we're talking about, but all weed killers chelate minerals and shut down enzymic systems. And the system shut down because the mineral that is the key cofactor for the enzymes, they're no longer available to them. So the bodies can't go ahead and do what they need to do and make the systems work. So let's take the example of my son's being sprayed before 3 years old. Now, and they got a large dose from
mm-hmm,
the
yes.
defense. What happened was, and Anthony Samsel also talks about this, and I can mention this if I can, because I think it's an extremely important point.
But you can mention anything you want as long as you don't start using words like Donald Trump.
No, don't worry about that.
Okay.
I think I'm a little bit more responsible.
Okay.
Okay. Well, anyhow, what happens is that the enzymic systems get shut down, and this is the part of the educational process that I went through to understand, because I really wanted to understand what happened to my boy.
Right.
Especially everybody, including the authorities, are telling me, oh, pesticides are harmless, herbicides are safe, they've been tested from the government, and to me, it's all hoax. It's a lie, and it's being proven now. Just an article came out yesterday that these pesticides, and glyphosate in particular, have other ingredients, inner ingredients that are more potent and powerful than the actual composition of the herbicide being discussed or the active ingredient.
Well, Shirley McComsey, who I interviewed a little while ago, and I believe you know her, was talking about glyphosate. I think it was her being an antibiotic.
Right.
Which, of course, is, you know, that sounds really good, but if you put an antibiotic in your gut because you've absorbed it through your nose, your mouth, or swallowed some, then it's going to kill your gut bacteria, and that's not good.
Right. Well, here's a bit of information that you probably don't know, and most of your listeners don't know, and this is from Anthony Samsel, and he says that 4-D is a patented antibiotic, just like glyphosate, and it destroys the gut immune function as well as enzymes. It is a structural analog of the plant phytomorine auxin, I hope I'm saying this right, IAA, let's say that, which is derived from the aromatic amino acid tryptophan. So it's taking the place of an amino acid.
So it's kind of a fake, I mean, a lot of, it's like for AIDS, the first drug was an analog of a part of your DNA. And so it stopped DNA from being produced, and it sounds like they're doing the same things with these chemicals. Is you take a chemical, you throw in a chlorine instead of something else, and it sort of fits in an enzyme pathway, but it disrupts it instead of allowing the normal process to occur.
Absolutely.
I also believe that 2,4-D and a similar 2,4,5-T were part of Agent Orange used in the Vietnam War,
I believe. Yes,
which,
you're right.
And I believe they were, well, part of the problem was they were contaminated with dioxins as well. So, that, I mean, which is not even an intentional component of the pesticide, right? It's just something that the process of producing them produced dioxins at very small amounts, but unfortunately dioxins are extremely toxic.
Just one last point here. You're absolutely right, David, concerning who did we see? We saw a lot of doctors and we talked to a lot of different people, including the scientists, but we have an actual tangible evidence of seeing in Calgary an allergist. Now, part of the rumors flying around the neighborhood here is that, oh, well, the kid was just allergic to you know, something in the house or whatever. So finally, after 6 months, when we were able to get in to see the allergist, and I have this, and I taped the whole thing, and we have all the documentation, and he put it in writing also, is that my children have no known allergy to foods, molds, toxins, anything.
Right. So, and you know, I don't think we give mothers and fathers enough credit that they're with their children every day, and you know, often maybe the mother spends more hours with the children, so they know what's going on with their children, and they see these changes, and you would have known if your children were allergic to something.
Absolutely.
You would have noticed that after certain things they threw up or got a rash or something like that, and you probably would have figured, okay, we got an allergy going on, and maybe figured out what it was. But you're saying there was nothing like that before this.
Well, that's an interesting point. And my children would get little reactions to different foods. And what we understand now is that glyphosate incorporates itself into different proteins, and it's all pervasive in our food system. So little doses of glyphosate in the Cheerios and the Ritz cracker and a different pesticide here and there is all accumulating in the little body. We're under the illusion, or we're being told that the bodies get rid of it. No, it accumulates in the body of the child, and so it's a little bit here, a little bit there, and you might get a symptom here and a symptom there. What makes this extraordinary in our situation is that my children got dosed heavily and damaged heavily, so the little doses now that most children can get, maybe get a headache or a little stomach thing or a little rash that said it's an allergy or whatever, now is affecting our children, you know, however much more.
I think it's uncontroversial that there are low levels of glyphosate in a lot of things. Allergies are very difficult to understand. I mean, sometimes people have an exposure to something, have very little reaction, and then the next time they're exposed, they have a fatal reaction. Or the little exposure might kind of immunize them to them. It's difficult to say. I mean, I'm not an expert, but maybe your children were sensitized to glyphosate, and then when they had a big exposure, it made the reaction even worse. We don't know.
And it's actually, it's the pathways that these chemicals travel and how they damage different systems in the body and the microbiome and the bacteria in the gut, which I think was the key for me to understand how everything was affecting my children. So now it's a matter of fixing the gut bacteria. And this is the process that Shelley and I are going through right now with ourselves and with our children. And I think what is going to be on an uphill climb for people to understand that they must do this if they want to prevent themselves from getting really bad diseases.
So what are you doing to try to repair the damaged gut of your children and yourself?
Well, the first thing is organic. We're trying to go as organic as possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the very first thing. So eliminate as many of the pesticides as we can.
Right.
Be very careful with the wheat and pastas and those different types of things.
Mm-hmm.
And also try to heal the bacteria in the gut from taking probiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And so Shelley probably can speak more about that because she experienced with the twins, healing them a little bit when she homeschooled them a year ago with probiotics that she was using and different other things that she was doing.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to hear about what probiotics you used and what kind of impact it had.
Do you want to speak? She's shaking her head right now.
No. Okay, well, we'll keep going. I mean, we're getting a lot of good information. I want to ask you, your children had been less exposed and had less of a reaction, and maybe you didn't even know that they'd been sprayed, could you have confused some of the symptoms, at least, with the flu?
Oh, absolutely, David. I think there's no question about it. And it's only because of the extraordinary situation that I realized, listen, in 2012, after the kids were sprayed, Shelley wanted me to phone the police and get the guy charged with trespass. And no, you know, I didn't realize how bad it was. And it took this progression of a few years until what happened, you know, I mean, they would get rashes and they would get this and they would get that. And, oh, it's just part of the normal process. But no, I understand now it was definitely from the herbicides and the continual absorption of the herbicides in their little system.
Right. So what you're saying is it took you a while to wake up because, like most people, you probably knew next to nothing about pesticides when you started this journey.
Absolutely. All I knew about pesticides is I hated the smell.
Right. I mean, I kind of had an innate dislike, but I guess I also had a biologist for a mother, and she was always talking about pesticides, so I guess I absorbed some of her, I remember talking about 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T when I was about 12 years old with my mother.
Goodness.
So.
Way ahead of the curve there.
Yeah, because, I mean, these are not new chemicals. I mean, the Vietnam War was the 60s and the 70s, right? And things, you know, everything's got a nice label on it, nice new, everything looks new, but, you know, they're recycling a lot of the same old chemicals.
Right.
That they had back then. I wanted to ask you about glyphosate, because my understanding of glyphosate is it's a general herbicide, kills everything, whereas 2,4-D is more specific to everything except grass. So people spray 2,4-D because it kills dandelions and things like that, but it doesn't kill grass so much. But I thought glyphosate killed everything, so why would somebody be spraying glyphosate? Wouldn't that even kill the grass?
Yeah, that's a good question. Look, I'm not an expert. All I know is what I've studied and what I understand about glyphosate and the latest research coming out. I mean, there was a document that just came out from Sarah Lane, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, where he talks about how glyphosate really, when they did all the tests and the studies, wasn't immediately toxic. It was all of the inert ingredients in it. So glyphosate seems to be a carrying molecule that brings all this other stuff into wherever it goes.
Oh, I see. This is a point you made to me when we talked before, and I think it's an important point, is that when these pesticides are tested, they test the active ingredients, such as glyphosate. But when you buy a product, whether it's Roundup, which includes glyphosate, or Killex, it also contains other ingredients that might be for enabling the spraying. They might turn it into a liquid that can be easily sprayed or something like that. And those are not tested. Like, the entire product is not tested.
That's right. And I think that is probably the most important point here is that, and that's why, you know, when we spoke earlier, I call it illusionocracy. And it's an illusion to think that either glyphosate or 2,4-D alone, any of these products, are safe because they're not testing the whole product.
Right. I mean, that just, it just seems crazy.
It's not really crazy. It's brilliant marketing. And I think that eventually we as a society and as Canadians in the sense that we're, you know, here concerned about this, we need to come down to the reality of the fact that this is all about money.
Well, I think you said Canadians, but I think it's bigger than that. I don't think I don't think if you were in the United States, it would be any different. The approval process, you know, superficially different, but basically the same pesticides are approved. And probably if you were in the United States and your neighbor was spraying you, you would probably have the same lack of recourse. If you went to the state police or whoever, they wouldn't know how to deal with it. Whereas if you stand on your land, maybe this doesn't apply in the United States. If you stand on your land and start firing a gun around in the air, you're probably going to have a policeman come and do something, because they understand that bullets kill people.
That's correct.
They don't understand that sprayed chemicals kill people.
That's correct. I think that's an important point, David. And I have one more point here concerning glyphosate, and it's in reference to a notice of objection to the reassessment decision of glyphosate by a PhD professor from the University of Quebec named Louise Vandenlack. Have you ever heard of her?
No. You're introducing me to a lot of new people.
Well, first of all, there was a really nice letter written by a conglomeration of the foundation, David Suzuki Foundation, Equiterre, Canadians, Physicians for the Environment, the Environment of Defense people, and then the Prevent Cancer Now. They wrote a letter specifically opposing glyphosate, and you can get it online, and it gives all the details. But this letter I'm going to refer to now talks about how when they reassessed glyphosate, which was done very recently, this letter was just April of this year. Of 2017. Anyhow, she says that they reapproved glyphosate based on the reevaluation decision of 2015. And that 2015 document that they used to reapprove it for 2017 took less than 1% of the actual scientific literature on health and environmental effects of glyphosate and glyphosate-based herbicides since the early 70s. And she thinks it's very highly problematic, and of course all of us do.
Let me guess, was it the 1% that said that there was no problem with glyphosate?
Less than 1% of the scientific literature.
What I'm saying is, did they pick the 1% of the scientific literature that didn't raise any problems for glyphosate?
Well, that's a good question.
I would imagine that's what they did. I'm just guessing.
That's a good question. The next fact is that she says the structural increase of the use of glyphosate through desiccation and through, the use of GMOs wasn't even considered. Consultations on the problems of glyphosate based on recent scientific tests were removed. They actually removed those tests from their approval process. And then the scientific scope targeted glyphosate and glyphosate products, even though coformulants are up to 1,000 times more toxic, which is what this new study just came out with a couple days ago. And the last point, the PMRA lacks the scientific basis to claim that they properly reviewed glyphosate.
Do you know what the sales are of glyphosate in Canada or around the world?
You know what? I don't have those figures, but I know that the use of glyphosate is like 2 billion kilograms or something. Kilograms.
And I'm sure a kilogram of a pesticide is selling for quite a bit. So we're talking billions of dollars.
Yeah, it's a multi-billion dollar industry.
And I think, anybody at the FDA, the EPA in the United States, or the PMRA or Health Canada, who stands in the way of a multi-billion dollar industry, whether it's the pharmaceutical industry or the pesticide industry, is not going to have their job very long. You probably are familiar with the guy at Health Canada who just recently died,
Dr. Shiv Chopra. As a matter of fact,
yes.
David, I actually went out and met him and spent some quality time with him and spoke to him about this very issue. And he actually talked to me about what happened to my son. In our conversations, he told me that, some of the letters that I received from Health Canada, the PMRA, he said was gobbledygook. He says it's a joke. He says none of it is appropriate because they don't do any testing. All they do is use policies and scientific literature that is handed to them from industry.
And he became famous many years ago, 1980s, I think, or 90s, when he was working for Health Canada, and he started publicly raising concerns about a product that was given to cows.
The bovine growth hormone.
Bovine growth hormone, which actually ended up not being approved in Canada. It was already approved in the United States, and it's very unusual for something to not be approved in Canada if it's not approved in the U.S. You invented the term illusionocracy, and we'll talk about delusionalism as well, but we sort of have a rubber stampocracy in Canada that whatever the Americans do, our bureaucrats spend a lot of money running around in circles for a while and then just rubber stamping the American approach to anything.
That seems to be the case, and that seems to be what I've discovered in my research of all of this. Now, in the United States, they have the equivalent to Shiv Chopra in E.G. Vellientos, who was a 25-year EPA scientist who blew the whistle, basically, and wrote a book called Poison Spring on the absolute corruption of the EPA.
Yes, yes. I was talking to a guy who was a beekeeper, and he was talking about the neonicotinoid pesticides and about how, I forget which U.S. government agency, the agricultural agency, was really in there to promote the sales of agricultural products, such as pesticides. It was not in there to protect agriculture.
Absolutely. Here, I'm going to give you a direct quote right now from his book. Is that all
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, the Office of Pesticide Programs, largest of the EPA, is essentially owned by the chemical pesticide industry. The EPA became a place where honest science became replaced by risk assessments and cost-benefit analysis, both of which serve as covers for putting the interest of industry ahead of the environment and public health. Now, this is what, of course, Shiv Chopra talks about in his book, and he gives a lot of details about the corruption and, of course, what E.G. Vellientos wrote about in his book. So the question becomes corruption at many levels of government.
Yes, I wish I could have interviewed Shiv Chopra. I didn't really think about him until he died. I knew of his reputation many years ago, but it's too late now. But you've given me a lot of other names. We're getting close to the end of our time. You haven't given up, and you've talked about setting up an organization and a website. Do you want to talk about what you're doing in that area?
Sure, I'd be happy to. First of all, we had the opportunity. I actually had three people come forward and say that they would fund any legal action I would take against these neighbors. We haven't totally ruled it out, but I didn't really want to go down that road because it wasn't really about getting back at anybody. It was mostly more about helping people understand the truth and what could happen to them.
Right.
So that's the direction we took. So in consultation with some associates and some friends of mine and some encouragement from some local people, I decided to start speaking out, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. And so in that process, we came up with a vision of education, protecting public health, and protecting the environment. And so we created something called the Holistic Community Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization designed to bring in funds to support groups and individuals who will stand for humanity and who will stand for scientific integrity.
And well, yes, I think for a long time industry has got away by calling people who are opposed to pesticides, want to eat organic food and stuff, a bunch of airy-fairy idealists who just don't know about reality. But actually, the more I get into these things, the more I realize science is on the side of those people who are fighting back, who don't want to see pesticides used carelessly and want to have organic food. I mean, there's solid evidence to back that up. And I mean, you mentioned cancer before. I mean, is cancer a big problem in your part of the world?
Well, I can tell you right now, I know of two people, one person who died of cancer right in the area where that has been sprayed, as well as someone else who was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And there's a couple of other couple animals that have had issues, and there's other health problems in the area. So, I mean, cancer is everywhere.
Yeah, it's hard to,
you can't pinpoint it. You can't say, oh, well, this happened because of that.
Right. It's different than what happened with your children because it happens so quickly. You know, if cancer occurs 10 years after you're sprayed with pesticides, it's impossible to say if there was a connection. But, we're dealing with increasing cancer rates and we're dealing with increasing use of pesticides. And unlike I remember in the 60s and 70s where people were, you know, really concerned about it, I think there's a lot of apathy about it. It's just kind of assumed. They've been around for 50 years now, so...
Absolutely. David, one of the things is that we talked about, well, people don't know. They're not educated. Well, I'm going to give you another quote from this book, Poison Spring, E.G. Vellientos, where he talks about how the chemical industry has been able to basically create the solution. And so he says... They have their lobbyists, and they lobby tirelessly. their representatives arrive for EPA meetings well-dressed and well-prepared to defend their interests. They know how to play the game. They come to meetings with slides, computer programs, fancy jargon, and colorful handouts pretending to deliver a scholarly exercise in the manner of a college seminar or a defense of a doctoral thesis.
Right, and plus they have their pet scientists who take, you know, quasi-secret payments from them.
Absolutely.
And then say what they want. There's been a few. There was one guy who was just outed as like that, who was speaking on the mainstream media about GMOs and things like that, without ever revealing that he was actually on the payroll of one of these big agricultural companies. Okay,
exactly.
So, famous last words.
Back to the Holistic Community Foundation. If
yes.
people are interested in what we're doing and would like to support us, the website is up. We have a team of individuals working on this. What we want to do is we want to start to galvanize people together, bring all of these wonderful activists together, and really start making an impact and a difference by education and putting out the truth.
Okay, so I will include a link to your website in the show notes. I'll get it from you afterwards, and you're welcome to post this interview when it's available in a week or two on your website as well, if that will help.
Very good. You know what, David? We just scratched the surface. I have a whole lot more that I could say.
I know. Maybe we'll talk again on the air sometime soon. I'd just like to thank you and your wife for joining me today, and I certainly wish the best of health for your children. I don't want to feel like I'm trying to prove a point about pollutants by seeing people sick. I would much rather that your children became perfectly healthy again.
Exactly, and I would rather not be doing what I'm doing, but I found compelled to, I have to do this now because I know the truth. And you can't just sit back now knowing the truth.
Yes, I agree. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, David.
Goodbye.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, thank you, Shelley. Goodbye.
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 Thank you for listening to episode 171 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.